I'm a real Luddite here. Somebody gave me a thing to record my talk with. So I hope it works. Well, I'm hoping I can get this into 30 minutes. I don't know. I haven't spoken for a long time. I've been in retreat for 16 years, and I came out of retreat to give this talk, and I go back tomorrow into retreat. So I my talk, it's not going to start out sounding very practical in some way, but I want to talk about my, my life path, not as a nun, by the way. I've only been a nun for 13 years, but I want to talk to you about my journey from being, I consider myself a philosopher, and since I was 13, I always wanted to be a philosopher, and I saw an enactment of the death of Socrates on television when I was 12 or 13, and I watched it, and I thought, that's what I want to be. That's it. I want to be a philosopher like he is. In other words, I wanted to live a philosophical life. As far as I knew, that meant you went to school and learned philosophy, so that's what I did. And it's led me through cognitive science, neuroscience, and back to philosophy again in a very interesting way. And I'd like to share that with you and share how it ties into the sense of suffering that we have as people, but also the sense of trying to eliminate sufferings in some way, because I see philosophy and all of its issues in the context of a way of life. So that's the first thing I want to say. So before I was a philosopher and before any of us sit around and listen to theories and read books and things, we have experiences, perceptual and mental experiences. And in those experiences, we experience ourselves and the objects of our awareness as separate things, as something separate and different. And this isn't a product, as I said, of theory. This is just how we see things. There's the object over there, and I'm here, and it's got its features and characteristics, and I have my features and characteristics. And so what happens when we get into theorizing about our experiences is that we try to incorporate that experience. We read that onto the world as a fact about the world. And so when I started studying philosophy in 1969, I started studying phenomenology. I was very interested in theories of mind, and my teacher was a phenomenologist, and I studied phenomenology, which is the whole theory of intentionality, the whole idea of subject-directedness towards objects as a structure of mental life. And it was in 1972, after 3 years of studying philosophy, that I started to be presented with texts by my teacher that criticized the idea of the whole notion of needing to have a representation to get in contact, and mental representation to bridge this gap between myself or my inner life or my mind and the objects of which I was aware. This whole notion that we bridge a gap between that subject and objects, with mental representations. And I started studying criticisms of that in philosophy, in terms of the philosophy of Maurice Merleau-Ponty and Aaron Gervich in the phenomenological movement. And then I studied it in psychology, in terms of the work of Goldstein and Gelb first, and then in various philosophical accounts of what was going on. And I was very interested in the failure of the model. And I finally wrote my PhD on the theory of intentionality, and I graduated in 1982 from the Catholic University at Louvain, Belgium. When I was in the early 80s then, I worked first as a postdoc here in the new cognitive science program at Berkeley. I was the second year. I was one of the what we called ourselves the Sloan Rangers. We were funded by the Sloan Foundation, so we called ourselves the Sloan Rangers. And I was the philosophical representative of that multidisciplinary team. At that time, that was the first time that we had these interdisciplinary kinds of talks. There were psychologists and computer scientists and engineers, but there weren't any neuroscientists. But we talked about, primarily that year, the big debate was, if you could model intelligent behavior using formal symbol manipulation in computer systems. The whole idea that was presented by Jerry Fodor in his books on formal symbol manipulation. And I felt that my job, and in fact my role in that group, happened to be a criticism of that, trying to point out the ways in which it was inevitably going to fail. It happened, however, that in 1981, I started studying neuroscience, and I met some mathematicians, made friends with some mathematicians at UC Santa Cruz and in LA, who were working on nonlinear systems modeling. And I was studying neuroscience, and a friend of mine out in L.A. said, you know, there's this guy working at Berkeley in the physiology department named Walter Freeman, who's modeling brain activity using these dynamical systems. And so I went in, while I was a member of the cognitive science, I also went over to Walter. And Walter and I began a 10-year odyssey together. We became colleagues. He eventually, after I was not a Sloan Ranger anymore, hired me in his lab, and I became a member of his team, and we worked together. And what I was really interested in when I got to his lab was that in neuroscience, too, there was this notion of representation being employed. In this case, it was neural representation. In other words, neural activity was thought to represent, was to bridge this gap between outside the organism and inside the organism. So they had this two, there was a general consensus when I joined forces with Walter that I learned from him of a model. There was a consensus model of what perceptual system functioning involved. And it was a two-level model in terms, they divided it up into two levels of functioning. One was, level one was, included two kinds of activity. One was receptor activity in your sense organ, so it's the immediate, the first level of neurons that interact. This was finely tuned kind of activity. It was very, it would only react to a very narrow range of stimuli. And it was a level of activity inside of this organism that didn't involve interaction at that level with any other element. So each element acted by itself, and it only fed its response, whatever its activity was only fed to the next level or the next series of, the next level aspect of level one functioning, which was post-receptor activity. At post-receptors, we see an introduction of feedback. And so what was happening here was a kind of activity that was integrative or comparative or contrasting kinds of activities that because of the, in virtue of the fact that they would interact with one another and not just feed everything forward, right? So now we get a level of feedback, which is really important. These two levels of, you know, feed forward and then feedback in small networks and using individual units was what was considered level one activity. And level two activity by the middle of the 1980s was considered to, was thought to include two kinds of activity. One was the activity of newly identified super network activity, which was activity of neurons in networks that were widely distributed in the cortex, but that would unify in some way by synchronized firing patterns. So they would be like, you could be in the next room and I'd be in this room and then we'd both, you'd start jumping up at one rate, and then I'd start jumping up, and that would unify us as far as the brain was concerned. If you use that metaphor, you can tell I'm a philosopher and not a neuroscientist. So. But the other kind of activity was something that Walter, I really think, is Walter's incredible contribution to neuroscience, and this was his discovery of neural mass activity, which was the activity, patterned activity of an entire neural mass. For example, the entire olfactory bulb would begin a patterned activity altogether as a group, as a unit. It would exhibit a global kind of unified activity. This wasn't a network activity. This was neural mass activity. So this is what I learned when I was studying with Walter in the beginning of the 80s. Walter's a great teacher of the history of neurophysiology. He's terrific. This is a mutual admiration society with me and Walter. But what really interested me as lab philosopher with Walter was the interpretation of all this in terms of representations. This idea that those first level of receptors were understood as feature detectors. In other words, they copied somehow, they represented a kind of copy of aspects of the stimulus, a copy of it. And those feature detectors then at the level of post-receptor activity were at post-receptor activity then got read as the first level of feature integration. So you have this idea that you got these things detecting individual features and passing that information along, and then you get to the level of post-receptors, and they start putting it together. They contrast it, they integrate it, and then what was thought was that the level 2 activity, which was the super network activity and so on, that activity was hypothesized to be the level at which all those things got integrated into a final correlate of a neural correlate of the percept. So either that was done with super networks, some people thought, or it might be done with neural mass. But the whole function of level 2 was to get a complete correlate. And the search for this internal correlate was called the binding problem. And by the end of the 90s, by the beginning of the 90s, this was the big thing to look for. And I have a feeling it's still the big thing to look for, having been to a conference in honor of Walter last winter and realizing that people were still worried about it. I managed in about 1984 or 1985, after 3 or 4 years of trying to formulate clearly to Walter the problem with the notion of representation, to convince Walter that it wouldn't work for his data. And we wrote some articles together about that, and they apparently fell on dead ears because it didn't have any real effect outside our lab. And so by the beginning of the 1990s, there were a couple things that really struck me. One was that there was absolutely no evidence for the existence of such a neural internal complete correlate of this percept. Absolutely none. There was a hypothesis it should be there, but there was no evidence. And the best and brightest in neuroscience had been looking for it for the last 40 years. And they thought, and they still think, I think, that they just didn't find it yet. However, I was aware of the history of representational thinking, and I was thinking that the situation was a lot more ominous, that this whole notion was leading us in a wild goose chase. And but I realized that even if I were able to go to enough conferences with Walter or alone, and we were going to we were like sort of missionaries out on a trip, you know. Even if we could run around and convince everybody else that they were wrong about the notion of representation, there was no alternative way of understanding. There was no model to replace the representational model in general. There was no overarching way of understanding the system, except in terms of representations. And with no model, you can't do research. You need some hypotheses. You need to investigate something. You need to be looking for something. So if you're looking for something, and the only thing you have to look for is representational entities, representation somehow, that guides your research. But if you have no model at all of what the alternative could be if you gave it up, you can't do science. And I totally had learned to respect scientists. I mean, I was in a lab with scientists, and I remember the graduate students, like, they would get really upset in the lab when we talked about no representations because, what do you got to offer us as an alternative? So in the early 90s, I was not anymore working with Walter in his lab, and I decided I was going to develop a non-representational account of what was going on. In other words, take the data and see if I could come up with something that didn't use representation. And I worked on that for, I worked on that for 3 years, and I came up with a model. And I just want to briefly talk about that model because it's based on an assumption that I want to carry on beyond neuroscience. I mean, I want to talk about beyond neuroscience. So I rejected the notion of representation. And I thought long and hard about representations, and I thought, what is the thing about representations that I got to get to? What is it about them that would, if I rejected them, that I'm really rejecting? And I realized what are representations? They're gap bridgers. They bridge gaps. They put things together that aren't in relation. And I thought, well, if you get rid of them and anything that looks like them, you got to get rid of the gap too. So the first hypothesis of the new model is there are no gaps. There's nothing to bridge. There aren't any breaks. Reality is a seamless web. Okay? That's my first assumption. Using that assumption, I had to describe what a perceptual system did to end up with the appearance or experience of a break. Okay? So I start with no breaks. That's the basic assumption of the model. I reject the notion of representation. I replace the notion of representation with a concept of use, biological and experiential level use. So I went back and I looked at the data. And it starts in the sense organs again. We're in perception again. I hope I'm not boring you with the perceptual models. But I'm back in this perceptual model. I'm back at the beginning of the whole story, at the, you know, where the story starts, it seems, in the body. And I'm looking, and it starts in the sense organs, right? Because since the 1950s, we're really biased in terms of information processing. Our tendency is to go right to the neurons. But I decided, well, just look at what sense organs are doing. And I looked at them, and I hypothesized two things based on what actually is happening there. First of all, sense organs do something very interesting. They've evolved in a way that they only interact with selective physical events. Eyes interact with light waves, ears with sound waves, tongues with chemicals, noses with chemicals. They're selective. And what that does is, in effect, is that selective ability to selectively interact with the environment creates a subclass of physical events or a subclass of physical interaction that's available to the organism. What is that doing? If we're considering the whole original situation as an unbroken web, it's starting to break up a web of physical interaction. It's starting to break it into these bits, right? For us, five senses and mental sense and so on. That's it. Okay. The second thing that I realized was that what happened there was a quite holistic event. If you look at the back of the eye, there's this complex light event that happens in the eye. Not light waves, it's a light event. It's projected on the back of the eye, right? It's a holistic event. It's not broken into parts. It's a holistic event. There's a holistic kind of nature to it. It's not broken up yet. There's no breaking it up. And I postulated that this was the holism that the neuroscientists were looking for. In fact, it wasn't a product of neurofunctioning at all. It was a function of sense organ functioning. That the whole was at the beginning and not at the end of the process, okay? Now, I'm doing this all in my house by myself, and I was actually working with Joan, who is my friend here, and her husband, who was at UCSF, and he came every week, and I tried to present him with this model, and we'd argue about it for 3 hours every week, and then I'd go back to my, and I'd write some more, and then I'd present more to him. So I was working on this at home. I'm thinking, boy, this is weird, but I'm just going to keep going. So I went to receptor neurons, and I thought, okay, what are these narrowly tuned, highly selective things really doing? And I thought, okay, now don't think of them as representations. Think of them as forms of use. And what are they doing? They're shattering that hole that occurs in the sense organ. They're pulling out elements. They're breaking up. In other words, they're bestowing discreteness on an event. They're creating bits out of something that inherently didn't have bits to start out with. That its form of functioning shows us that discreteness is being created by this organism in its functioning. And the reason I realized that it was creating bits was not to internalize features, but to provide post-receptor activity with bits that it could contrast, could bring into relations. And what that did was it created qualitative qualities in those by virtue of relating. In other words, the color red for a human being has a certain quality to it. And it has those qualities not because the wavelength is the wavelength it is, but because of the relationships that it's brought within, inside the system. Red light and green light are contrasted by our system. Whereas if you're a bird, you don't just have our visual spectrum of light to work into contrast relationships at post-receptor activity. You also have infrared and ultraviolet. So red is not red. doesn't have that quality that it does for us. So the qualities that were being created, the qualitative character of that holistic event, were being created by the forms of relationship that were biologically based and relative to the organism. So everything about that object qualitatively would be due to the relationships that were totally happening inside the organism. So edges are relative to my system, because I'll tell you, an ant does not see the edge that I see, right? It's relative to a body like mine, to the relationships in which everything can be brought. Colors get their quality from it. In fact, objects become objects by virtue of the features that they have. And that's because of the relationships in which things are brought. So that was how I saw the second level of functioning. So now I've got sense organ functioning and post-receptor and receptor functioning, and now I was left with level 2 functioning. And so I didn't have a copying of features. I had a creation of feature qualities. I didn't have a whole that I needed to be brought together anymore. And now I had to look at these patterns at the level 2 activity. I assigned the supernetwork activity to the same level as post receptors, because I believe that the true level 2 perceptual system functioning is Walter's mass action. Because we don't have to put anything together anymore, and we don't have to get any features together. So what the heck is this thing doing? And I took very seriously the fact that it was generating a form of system activity. And what I felt was that system activity was creating a form of systemic use for the organism. It was creating systems, because systems aren't anatomical facts. Systems are forms, global forms of use for the organism. So I hypothesized that these level 2 neuromass action were, in fact, responsible for creating system activity, systems, which are, in fact, a form of use, not a fact of an anatomy, but a form of use. So it's now it can have an olfactory kind of use, it can have a visual form of use, and it's a system. It's been united as a system. It isn't just happening in an ear and an eye. In other words, this second level of neural activity is breaking the organism itself up now into subsystems of use. So we got another breaking up. It's not that it, and I believe probably the anatomy reflects the fact that it has those forms of use ultimately, that the anatomy is generated out of the use and not the other way around. The other thing was that by the way, these subsystem uses can't be generated unless they're all connected with other parts of the brain. There has to be feedback with all the parts of the brain in order for these to be generated, which also seems to mean to me that, hey, this is about the whole thing. This is about the whole system is doing something, is trying to get itself to be broken up into something. The other thing that was really remarkable about Walter's patterns was that they never were strictly identical. There wasn't a one-to-one correspondence between the stimulus and the patterns that he found. He only found patterns with respect to a stimulus that bore a family resemblance, kind of like me and my sister sort of look like we belong to the same family, but we're not strictly identical, right? I mean, I have my dad's nose, so I bear some, but my sisters don't have that nose, but they have a mouth part that, or an eyes or whatever, you know, and so you look and you say, hey, that's the same family, right? Or like when you're playing, following a rule. Following rules, for example, as Wittgenstein pointed out, wasn't ever strictly anything, but within a context, you could say, hey, that's following the rule and that's not following the rule, right? Or like bicycle riding, which is my favorite, which is, there's this kind of thing that's bicycle riding, but there's no real, I mean, there's not one thing that's bicycle riding. Ride up a hill, ride down a hill, be fat, be thin, be tall, ride a tricycle, blah, blah, blah. There's not like one thing, right? And this was the problem in cognitive science and computer science. They were trying to find this one definition of everything this one representation, and they never found it, right? But what did you find? You found this family kind of resemblance. And I hypothesized that by being able to create a kind of family resemblance, a kind of similar use, you were creating the possibility for the object, in this case, to be the same, to serve as the same thing. In other words, this kind of similarity of use would confer similarity or sameness on the stimulus. So now we've got identity, and we've got the organism broken up into subsystems of use, and at the level of the global system, in other words, at the level of mind and body, this complex that's a being that perceives, we now have a system that is able to use aspects of its results of aspects of its own functioning as objects, as opposed to itself. So now we have a global mind-body functioning level. We've got the possibility of subjects and objects meeting each other across a gap. So that was my model. I wrote a book on it. I finished the book in 1995. It was accepted for publication. It was in galley stages, and then it was suddenly pulled from. And that's, I don't know, something happened. I'm not quite sure what happened. But I managed to publish a little article on this, and it's totally ignored. But it doesn't really matter, because I didn't stop. So in 1995, when I finished this book, and I was left, I felt that as a philosopher, I'd pretty much accomplished the things that as a philosopher with respect to neuroscience, I felt qualified to address. One was that I'd dissolved the binding problem, basically. I found a way to get rid of a problem as a pseudo-problem. And dissolving problems is what I think that philosophers are best at. Is like say, hey, you only had that problem because you understood the whole thing wrong, right? So I was really proud of that. I thought, I can offer an account of that would allow you not to have this problem. So that was, and I had developed an alternative theoretical model that one could use to predict certain kinds of things and to search, to understand perceptual system functioning and make predictions about what you might or might not find. It might be wrong. I mean, this might be wrong, but the thing was there was a model. I had an alternative model, and it's available. I published an article on it, and it's available. It's out there. So I felt I'd done that. I felt that I had explained how this appearance, this experience of separation of subject and object had been generated in a system without needing the physical reality to be that way. And those are the three things that I felt that I was able to accomplish. However, in 1995, I was personally left as a philosopher with a couple of things that were troubling to me, and I am a philosopher. So the fact that mind-body functioning in perception created this appearance of a gap or separation where there wasn't, in fact, one, even though evolutionarily this was successful, I mean, perceiving organisms are quite successful. We live and we reproduce and blah, 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 yeah? That's not a problem. But for a philosopher, that's a problem because that's an illusion, right? An illusion for a philosopher who wants to live and see things how they are truly, the illusion that's created by perceptual and mental functioning is not satisfactory and acceptable. So I wondered whether the illusion itself could be eliminated from experience and what it would mean if that were eliminated. And second of all, my main interest since I was knee-high to a grasshopper, well, I was never that small, actually. I was always tall. But, yeah, my grandfather called me spider legs, so you can tell. It's like, you know, I was like, yeah. But anyway, my interest in philosophy from the very beginning was this mind-body issues. And here I saw mind-body functioning creating the appearance of a gap where there wasn't one. And I wondered whether it might not be that mind-body functioning actually generated the mind-body problem. That it, in fact, created a dichotomy, the appearance of a dichotomy where there isn't one. And I wonder how I could investigate that, right? How do I get at that? Neuroscience can't tell me that. I can't go to philosophy in the West. I couldn't ask cognitive scientists. So now I've gone through philosophy in the West, cognitive science, neuroscience. So I'm in 1995. Well, it turns out that in 1992, I went to India specifically to meet the Dalai Lama. Because I had this idea about perception, and somebody told me I should go ask him. So I went to India, and I didn't have any, like, I didn't have any introduction, or I didn't have anything. I just arrived at the gates of his palace, and I said, I need to see the Dalai Lama. Because I thought, well, I just thought you could go see him. So anyway, it took me 3 months of, like, manipulating, and I finally did get to see him, and I got to spend 3 days with a group of people who were doing a conference. And on the second day, I got to meet with him privately, and so I could ask him. I asked him, can I meet? Would it be possible? So anyway, so I told him a little about my ideas about perception that I was developing in my writing, and he said, you know, I think you really have strong karma for studying this stuff, you know, and that would be really, you'd be well advised to study Buddhist philosophy, particularly the theory of emptiness, which is the idea that things don't inherently exist as separate independent entities. So I said, great. And I started studying. So from 1992 until 1995, I studied the Buddhist theory of emptiness, and I did a complete retreat on it for 3 years while I was writing my book. I studied primarily the texts by Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and Tibetan commentary on those texts. And what I found was, to me, was really relevant to everything I was really interested in. First of all, I found out that at the time of Socrates, Buddha had indicated very clearly that this structure of subject-object, this intentional structure, this kind of, was the thing that people needed to pay attention to. That this was the characteristic of all of our experiences, all ordinary experience, and it needed to get paid attention to. And he described it quite clearly. And not only did he describe it, he also said it resulted from the functioning of what he called the contaminated aggregates. Now, I don't want you to think that, like, I had to translate all this, like, into English. And what are contaminated aggregates? But basically the way the mind and body ordinarily function. So he said this appearance of separation or independence was due to the functioning of the mind and body. Hey, that's cool. That's 500 BC, right? But not only that, he said that separation, that experience of separation built into all ordinary experience is the source of all suffering. Hey. Now, as a philosopher, not being satisfied with this distortion being there, that made my ears prick up, right? That's the problem. Out of all the things that it could be, that's the problem, right? And then what really got me was, not only did he know there was a problem and knew where it came from, he said there were methods to eliminate it. Oh, my goodness. So Miss Christine Philosopher was off and running. So from 1995 until the present, I've been in retreat and working on this. So the first thing I did was to do the Buddha. Buddhism contains a set of methodologies and practices for getting at isolating this factor of experience, meditating on it, and using certain methods to get at it. Then the first thing you do is you do meditation on emptiness, at least in the way I was doing it. So I look at an appearance, I isolate this aspect of it, this independent existence of this thing, and then I engage in certain analytical meditation. I'm analyzing the phenomena that I'm focused on, and then I focus on the lack of independent existence when I finish the analysis, so the result of analysis. And this process, what it does over time, is it moves you from a completely intellectual understanding to a mildly conceptual understanding to a direct presentation of the absence of that independence in a meditative experience. Oh boy, I've got 3 minutes. Okay, so that's one thing. And what happens is that if you're able to move to the level of complete realization, it eliminates the possibility of suffering completely. Because what it does is it takes out the notion, it takes out your belief in the The appearance of independence is still there, but it takes out the force of it because it undercuts it completely. And so those mental states, you can't cling on to things as if they inherently exist, trying to get them over to you. You can't hate things as possessing certain qualities in themselves because those qualities are all in relationship and so on. But what happens is that you still see it as if it's in, you still see it or think about it as if it were independent. But it's possible to get rid of even the appearance. And this involves extremely advanced kinds of meditational practices and an incredibly rich understanding of mind-body functioning that's only in more advanced practice and actually only found in Tibetan Buddhism. And this was an understanding of the body at three, mind-body functioning at three levels. The first level is what they call gross functioning, which is ordinary sensory functioning and ordinary mental functioning. And at this level, things are experienced intentionally, subject, object, right? There's a, however, below that level, there's a subtle level of mind-body functioning, which they describe in terms of energy channels and winds. This, at this level, it's much less dualistic. And finally, there's a level of mind-body functioning that's totally non-dualistic, a state out of which this whole mind-body experience of separation and object-subject and stuff is generated, which is totally non-dualistic. And in practice, there are methods that one uses, from extremely interesting visualization techniques to yogic techniques, for accessing each of those levels, for exploring each of those levels, and for experiencing how one level emerges from the other. In other words, to putting yourself into the second level and then watching the third, the gross level emerge out of it, as if you were coming out of a sleep state, for example, where you suddenly hear things again and are able to see things visually again. You're actually able to control that. So, this brings me to the end because I only have like 1 minute. So what I found in the process in my life is that understanding, I read a book when I was in 1972 when I was 20 years old that was called The Primacy of Perception. And I always wondered exactly what the primacy of perception meant because it didn't really explain exactly in the book. But I think I understand what it is now. And that is that in perception itself, we find the root of suffering. And hence, the obstruction, a kind of obstruction to living a truly philosophical form of life, which is a life based on self-examination and truth, wisdom, right? So we find that rooted in perceptual experience. And that illusion is responsible for suffering, for ignorance, for unhappiness. And that discovery, the discovery of that allows us to discover methods for accessing the causes, for dealing with those causes, for addressing them, which leads to our understanding of emptiness or this ontological status of things, which leads us to the mind-body in which it's all rooted and mind-body functioning, which eventually leads us to a state in which we see how these things emerge from a non-dualistic, non-intentional, non-separative state. Which I think, in the end, and according to Buddhism, is the state when one is able to achieve that, to access that and use it, one has achieved what they call enlightenment, nirvana, Buddhahood, and what I would call is the philosophically wise life. So that's what I wanted to talk about. So thank you very much.